Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
And Ken, another week President Obama would probably rather forget.
There were times, not too long ago, where everything seemed to be going in the Democrats' way and the Republicans were getting hammered and hammered, as Ron and I usually do before we start the podcast. But this has not been a couple of good weeks for the Democrats or the White House.
Maybe we should stop talking about bad weeks for the president and talk about a bad month for the president. In fact, you could say, in some respects, it started on June 1st.
Well, I think almost every time we have a June, it starts on June 1st.
Yes. Okay. All right. Fair observation. And in this particular instance, on June 1st, we got the bad jobs report. This was the 60-some thousand odd jobs that
were
created.
Way down from what they predicted.
Yeah, well, they were predicting 160 or 150 at least. And so it looked like they were missing a digit. It looked like they had just gotten the wrong, you know, number up there on the screen. And I think the people at the White House felt they'd been kicked in the stomach. And a lot of people just thought, wow, this economy's not doing nearly as well at creating jobs as we expected it to do progressively.
But that's not true.
Straight on through to November.
Yeah, but that's not true because I understand the private sector is doing really well.
Doing just fine.
Yeah.
Well, what the president said a week later on June the 8th was, now, we're trying to create jobs here. The job creation hasn't been exactly what it was supposed to be. He was basically on message saying the things about the economy, trying to put the best face on it that he's been doing now for some time. Only he segued into saying, when talking about job creation, that the big problem was the loss of jobs in the public sector while the private sector job creation number was still going up. So the way he puts it is private sector is doing just fine. Whoops. You chop that out. It's a little bit like when Romney said he liked firing people who didn't do a good job. Well, that gets chopped into, I like firing people, and that doesn't look so good, sounds so good, and that's exactly what happened with this. And it fits perfectly the whole Republican analysis that Obama's just not really all that troubled by what's happening in the private sector.
And watching the president campaign this week and talk about how all the Republicans want to do is just blame the Democrats, blame the Obama White House, whereas how many times have you heard President Obama use the word, I inherited this mess? I mean, everything is true. As president, you do have to have a record to fall back on, and after 3+ years of his presidency, it's fair to decide what is Obama's fault. But for Obama to ridicule Republicans and Romney by saying all they're doing is pointing fingers at me, when many people can say that Obama's been pointing fingers at the Republicans and President Bush, I mean, that's basically what this campaign is all about.
At some point or another, if you're president of the United States, you own the status quo. In some fairness to them, in the swing states, you look at the states around the Great Lakes, that could go either way, particularly Pennsylvania, Ohio, say
Michigan,
Wisconsin.
Those
states, unemployment is down substantially and is much better than it is nationwide. Nationwide, it ticked up this last month to 8.2. A lot of these other states, they're down under 7.
And who do you credit for that uptick? Do you credit President Obama or do you credit the Republican governors in all those states? And that's what's interesting to me, because in February, March, when the economy seemed to be doing better, when more jobs were being created, it was because of the Obama administration. Now that fewer jobs have been created than most people expected, who do we blame for that? The Bush administration? The Republican governors? That's what's so interesting. When the news looks good,
You take credit.
But who should get the credit here?
Arguably, none of the politicians in this equation are really responsible for either the improvement in the economy or for the slowing of the improvement in the economy. There hasn't been that much change in policy in the last year or two, really. So a lot of this is playing politics with a set of circumstances none of the politicians really is responsible
and
for.
I know we have 5 months to go before the election, but how many people go into the voting booths in November and say, you know, if it wasn't for that European crisis, I feel much better about this economy. All I know is that my earnings are less, my job security is less, my children's security is less, and who do I blame? Do I blame Bush? Do I blame Herbert Hoover? Or do I blame the guy who's in the White House now? Ultimately, what the Romney campaign may be thinking is that this election will be not Obama versus Romney, but Obama versus not Obama. We saw that in Wisconsin, too. I don't think it was really Tom Barrett versus Scott Walker. It was Scott Walker or not Scott Walker. But as we get closer to November, as the debates heat up, obviously Romney's going to have to explain to the voters what he's going to do differently than the president, and then ultimately that will be the choice.
And he will not really have to have a fully formed program. He will not necessarily have to say who his cabinet is going to be, but the president is going to be responsible for his program, for however things are going, and for his own cast of characters, including his cabinet, and that this week once again proved itself to be a vulnerability for the White House.
We see that in the Commerce Department. We see that in the Justice Department.
The Commerce Department, of course, was not expecting to have any problems. John Bryson, who's a former Southern California electric utility executive, was considered to be a highly safe choice for Commerce Secretary. And apparently what happened to him over the weekend, last weekend, was that he had some sort of a seizure, according to doctors, and that this caused him to strike a vehicle twice that had several people in it. No one was seriously injured, but he did hit the car, and then he left the scene of the accident, which is a serious crime, and then he ran into another car. And, of course, this appeared, at least initially, to be a case of somebody who was out of control, and we could all sort of imagine leaping to some sort of judgment about why he was out of control and what he might have done to impair his judgment. And then we got the explanation that he passed a drug and alcohol test with no impairment from those causes, and instead it was due to some medical condition leading him to have a seizure.
Yes, but before we got that actual diagnosis, for the longest time, and maybe it was even a short amount of time, but it seemed like the longest time, on Twitter, on Facebook, there were tons of speculation that Bryson was drunk, that he should be forced out of the cabinet, another Obama blunder.
Well, okay, and of course, whatever the immediate humor on Twitter or whatever the immediate speculation on Facebook may be, that shouldn't be seen as the last word on any incident of this kind. But at the same time, it does go into the books, as it were, as another unfortunate incident affecting the president, affecting the efficacy of the cabinet at a particular moment when Eric Holder, the president's attorney general, was about to go before yet another congressional committee to take yet another public whipping from Republicans who want him to resign his office.
In short, you violated the public trust, in my view, and by failing and refusing to perform the duties of your office. So, Mr. Attorney General, it's more with sorrow than regret than anger that I would say that you leave me no alternative but to join those that call upon you to resign your office.
That was Texas Senator John Cornyn, who is expressing the views of many Republicans who just feel that Holder's effectiveness as a member of the cabinet has come and gone.
All right. Fast and Furious, of course, was that program by which the Justice Department allowed some guns to leave the country to fall into the hands of criminals so that they could then trace the guns and maybe catch the criminals. And some of those guns were used in the killing of a Border Patrol agent. Let's get back to Eric Holder responding to John Cornyn the other day in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee.
I am willing to sit down and talk about the provision of more materials. I have sent letters in that regard. The Deputy Attorney General has sent letters in that regard and have not had responses, which leads me to believe that the desire here is not for an accommodation, but for a political point making. And that is the kind of thing that, you and your side, I guess, have the ability to do if that's what you want to do. It is the thing that I think turns people off about Washington. While we have very serious problems, we're still involved in this political gamesmanship.
Well, we are indeed involved in political gamesmanship here in Washington, no question about it. And by the way, the senators are really kind of jumping on a bandwagon here. This is really Darrell Issa's investigation coming out of the House Committee on Government Reform and Oversight. And Darrell Issa has been on this for years. He has had Holder before him many times. They've been back and forth about some documents that Issa says he needs to see. And Holder says, no, that has to do with people that are still being prosecuted and I can't release them. So it's one of those disclosure, non-disclosure arguments between the executive and legislative branches, longstanding. And the senators really, in this hearing, are really jumping on Issa's bandwagon.
No, that's absolutely true, but it just seems like a big tit for tat. We saw it with Bork, we saw it with Jim Wright, we saw it with Gingrich, we saw it with Bush, we saw it with Clinton judicial officials being blocked by Republicans, we saw it by Bush judicial officials being blocked by Democrats, we saw it by Obama political officials being blocked by Republicans. Everybody seems to remember the last fight. I don't know what lessons they learned, but they remember the last fight and they're determined that, well, they did it to us, we'll do it to them.
That's actually a very good catalog of the last, 25 years in congressional history, although you did leave out the biggest one of all, the impeachment of Bill Clinton.
Other news for the Justice Department, they will not retry former Senator John Edwards.
Good decision.
Well, something, I hate to say that, hasn't John Edwards suffered enough?
No, I don't think he has, but he will over time in all likelihood.
Well,
but we don't get into moral judgments here on the podcast.
Well, we certainly have humiliated him enough, and perhaps maybe...
He's the third most humiliated person on this podcast.
Besides Elving and Rudin?
That would be correct.
But we've already established the fact that John Edwards is a sinner. John Edwards has acknowledged that. But my goodness, listening to that testimony for days and days and days, the fact that he's covering up this whole thing as he's trying to run for president, as he's trying to get on the ticket
as his
wife vice president, as
his wife battling
is battling cancer. If nothing else has come out of this case, aside from the fact that it's cost the government and the defense millions and millions of dollars, it has probably ended once and for all any thought of John Edwards ever being in the public eye again. And I think, in a sense, that's a good thing.
Perhaps, and maybe that was the intention of the North Carolina U.S. attorney who really pressed to have this case brought to trial. And certainly the Justice Department could have put the brakes on it at some point or another, but their public integrity division wanted to press this ahead, particularly after the embarrassment that they had had in the Ted Stevens trial. This has really not been a good stretch for them. And when they brought these charges, and of course the jury, after many, many days of deliberation, acquitted him on one count and deadlocked on five other felony counts, the result of that is, who really believes that another trial would serve any great public purpose? And certainly they couldn't be guaranteed of a different result. They put out the evidence they had, and it just didn't seem to add up to something that would send the man away to jail for years and years.
We were talking about the bad month the Obama administration and the Democratic Party have been having. The last thing they wanted to focus on was John Edwards. Another thing they didn't want to focus on was a defeat in Arizona's 8th congressional district, the one vacated by Gabby Giffords.
This would have been really put together with a Wisconsin setback and all the rest of this. This would have really been a terrible, terrible black shroud around the Democratic Party. But it didn't happen. In the end, Gabby Giffords' former aide, Ron Barber, who was her handpicked successor in the district, managed to pull it out in this special election. He won with 53% of the vote.
Yeah, it wasn't a landslide, but it was certainly a larger amount than what Gabby Giffords defeated Jesse Kelly in 2010.
Which was, of course, a huge Republican year when we didn't have the hangover of this tragedy that has happened in the district since. But it was a huge relief to Democrats not to lose this one, where, again, as in Wisconsin, I would say the local overriding consideration was much more important than the national implications that we all draw from it later on. But in this case, people kept calling it Gabby's seat. All the media called it Gabby's seat. And the idea of it going to the man who had opposed her and run a pretty rough campaign against her in 2010, much of which was brought back unfairly and used against him in the 2012 campaign.
Why unfairly?
Well, because the things that he was saying in 2010, he would never have said in 2012.
But he said it. I mean, my argument was he was a flawed candidate from the beginning. This is a Republican district, although this will not be a Republican district come November because it's been restructured to giving it a Democratic advantage. Special congressional elections are always interpreted way beyond the borders of what it should be. It's interesting that in Wisconsin, with Scott Walker not being recalled, status quo prevailed in Arizona's 8th congressional district. With all the hubbub about what it might mean, status quo prevailed. The Democrats held the seat. One thing we shouldn't forget is that in a big, big Republican year in 2010, where Republicans were winning everywhere, Democrats were running for their lives, basically, in Arizona, two Democratic House members went down to defeat. Gabby Giffords still won in 2010.
And because you think Jesse Kelly was a flawed candidate in 2010.
He was a weak candidate. He was probably more extreme. And the issues that he worked on in 2010 regarding Social Security and Medicare and
phasing them out.
Exactly.
Ponzi schemes.
Probably didn't help him. But I think ultimately a lot of this was about Gabby Giffords, her legacy, and the fact that she anointed Ron Barber, who ran a very moderate campaign. It wasn't vituperative.
No, he ran away from Obama.
He ran away from Obama. He asked whether he would support him in 2012. He refused to give an answer.
Later he said he would. But he wouldn't say on the spot. He just sort of tap danced.
It's very possible that when Arizona voters in this district go to the polls in the August primary, Jesse Kelly, the Republican, may not be the Republican nominee once again, because I think the Republicans feel that if it's a winnable seat, it will have to be with a different candidate.
I think it's fair to bring back all the things he said in 2010 on the issues, because presumably he hasn't changed any of those views. What was unfair was the ad that took a statement that he made in 2010 about how Gabby Giffords came back to the district with that smile on her face, making it sound right. Like the way she looks now,
right,
coming back from her extraordinary therapy from this gunshot wound that she got in January of 2011. That is ghoulish and awful, and in the implication that he had said it since she was wounded, I think did did the Democratic Party some disservice by using that particular quote. But all the positions, all the stuff that he said, well, maybe I'm not as extreme now about Social Security and Medicare and the flat tax at 10%. That's all fair game.
There were also a bunch of primaries to watch on Tuesday. Virginia, no surprise. Former Senator George Allen won the Republican primary pretty handily. He's trying to get his seat back. Remember, he lost to Jim Webb 6 years ago following his unfortunate macaca comment. Allen will now face Tim Kaine, former governor, former DNC chair, in what will be clearly one of the premier Senate races of the country.
Absolutely. And no surprise, as you say, that he got the Republican nomination, although at one time there was some doubt about whether or not he'd be popular enough with the new Tea Party forces in Virginia. He did not have any trouble sweeping aside a couple of challengers, and that will surely be one we're watching. In North Dakota, a number of interesting ballot measures were voted on this week, and the voters, among other things, decided not to abolish the property tax. This would have been the first state in the union to abolish the property tax. There are some that don't have one, but this would have been the first state to get rid of one it has. A lot of people thought that was a pretty appealing idea now that they've got a lot of revenue coming in from natural gas and oil drilling there in the state. But 70% of the people in the state decided, no, we're gonna hang on to the property tax. That was rather an extraordinary result. They also voted down a religious liberty ballot measure that was supposed to give people more ability to claim religious reasons when they were prosecuted for violating certain kinds of state law, giving people essentially a religious exemption from certain state laws.
And a shocking result that of Illinois. It's not regarding a primary, but I understand that Congressman Joe Walsh, a freshman Republican, has endorsed his Democratic opponent, Tammy Duckworth?
Actually, no. Joe Walsh endorsed Tammy Duckworth, yeah, the opponent of Joe Walsh, but the Congressman Joe Walsh was not the Joe Walsh who was endorsing. It was that other Joe Walsh.
Huh?
And that's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
And were you ever with the Eagles?
Huh?
Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR.